We're gonna need a blowtorch and some more peanut butter.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Greetings, listeners, fellow Odysseans, writers, rodeo clowns from the Ninth Dimension, Cincinnati Maenads, and Ebenezer, to episode 10 of The Drunken Odyssey, now with even more John King. On today's show, I'll be having a wonderful talk with the poet Lauren McClung. Claude Clayton Smith writes about John Updike, and I do my best, yet again, to answer your mail. My goals for the summer included writing 3 short stories of proper length. With a little more than 1 week of summer break left, I am about halfway through the second story. I wrote this wonderful tour de force scene and thought I had perhaps lost it, but it turned out to be in my office at school on a yellow legal pad I almost never use. Thank you, Dean Martin, for shining a light there. So for the last few weeks, I've been trying to woo my major professor from my PhD work, the fabulous Bob Lamb, onto the show to talk about Hemingway. Bob's book is called Art Matters, Hemingway, Craft, and the Creation of the Modern Short Story, and I need to get him on the show because Hemingway is too important to be left to the likes of me to talk about. Bob is brilliant and passionate and often wickedly funny, too. Like Hemingway, Bob has a great affection for cats, so dear listeners, please help me persuade Bob that his voice is deeply desired by you by sending in photos of your own cats reading Hemingway. This is a group effort, and I'm hoping to make a gallery of them on the website. Our love and numbers will prevail. I don't know what I'm talking about anymore. The Drunken Odyssey family seems to be having a good week. Vanessa Blakesley, who had an essay on episode 2 of our podcast, has just had her short story, Melocchio, appear in Southern Humanities Review. Congratulations, Vanessa. Olivia Kate Cerrone, who had an essay on episodes 1 and 5, has just won the 2012 Mason's Road Literary Award with her story, The Rabbi's Son. Congrats, Olivia. And Monica Wendell, who was our guest on episode 5, has just had her new book of poems, No Apocalypse, selected as the 2012 Georgetown Review Press Poetry Manuscript Contest winner. Congrats, Monica. Holy crap. Wow. In a month's time, I'll be moving from where I've been living here in the Villages, Florida, so that I can actually live in the same general metropolitan area as the place where I work. Perhaps by October, I won't feel like the wheels are coming off, gang. Plus, I don't want to live in a place where Mitt Romney likes to sing.
Beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountains' majesty above the fruited plain. America, America, God shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea.
Let's get to the interview.
And now, the interview of the day.
On today's show, I'm joined by Lauren McClung, author of Between Here and Monkey Mountain, which was released earlier this year by Sheep Meadow Press. Welcome, Lauren.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the publication, and also congratulations on the publication so soon after finishing up the MFA, at least I think so soon after finishing up the MFA.
Thanks a lot.
So what was your MFA experience like there at NYU?
Yeah, the MFA program was really good for me. I didn't know how I was going to feel going back to grad school at that point in my life. I was in my late 20s. I made great connections. The conversations that happened in that space were so important to me for my writing. I've been writing my whole life, but I didn't take it as something I could devote my life to. I always thought of it as, well, this is what I do, and I'll always have to do some other, you know, work. So it's kind of nice to think of it. Of course, I'll still always have to do some other work. I'm a poet, so it would be realistic. But I see this as a full commitment. So I'm glad I had the opportunity to take the time to commit myself to it.
Yeah, I think there is that aspect to MFA programs where it's, oh, shit, I better produce something.
Yeah.
This is kind of a big fucking commitment, so.
Yeah.
So who did you study with?
I was really lucky. My first semester, I studied with Sharon Olds, and I had been reading her work for over 10 years already. In fact, her poetry let me realize that some of the family subjects I was taking on, it was okay to take those subjects on in poetry. So she's the first person I really studied with at NYU. I had other kinds of courses. I studied with Ann Carson in her collaboration class, studied with Phyllis Levin in a craft class, Yusuf Komunyakaa.
What was it like studying with him?
He's great. He was really focused on, in office hours, he was particularly focused on pushing me a little bit further, especially because of my subject, to confront history, whether that's in a personal way or in a more political way. I think that's something that happens in a lot of his work as well, and I think that led me to ask a lot of questions, whether it's through research or talking with my father or through my own personal meditation.
Well, and I think it is really a challenge to engage with all those things and still somehow make it artful and convey a sense of what poetry is supposed to convey. What was your writing? You said you've been writing your whole life. What was your writing life like before going into the MFA program?
As a kid, I was writing song lyrics. You know, it was sort of my first love was music. And I started writing poetry in grade school, really. They were, you know, formal poetry. And I discovered E. E. Cummings in high school, so I tried the experimental concrete poetry or more avant-garde feel. I was also a filmmaker for my early college life. Like, that was my first college degree is in production, and I worked in that field for 10 years. So I saw poetry as kind of connected visually in the same way. But a lot of my stuff was sort of more conceptual or experimental, concerned with craft and music. My writing started to change really in 2007 drastically when I finally was starting to give readings. It was really important for me that if my readers, my listeners, encountered my work upon that first encounter, that they didn't leave baffled, that they were able to take away something meaningful from that. Maybe not everything, because I think, you know, there are many layers to how we can read a poem. And sometimes it calls you back and you have to keep returning to it. But I wanted my reader, my listener, upon that first encounter to be able to find something that makes sense to them.
Was that before you got to NYU, or was that sort of coinciding with when you joined the program?
It was sort of coinciding with that. Yeah. So in that same year.
I know also that you, while you were at NYU, you did work with veterans, which seems to also coincide with a lot of the subject matter of your book.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the great work that you were doing there while you were at NYU.
The NYU Veterans Writing Program started in 2008, in my second year of graduate school, and I was the first fellow to lead the workshop. It was started by Jean Kennedy Smith. And many other people at NYU had been a part of that decision. The program itself was really important for me. For many of those writers, it was their first time trying to kind of process their experiences and confronting themselves in different ways. And it did coincide with my own work and what I was doing with my father. I'd been talking to him. I'd started talking to my father about 10 years ago regarding his experience in war. It was very difficult at first for both of us because a great deal of silence has existed for him ever since that moment in Vietnam, that year for him. And I found that these veterans had carried a lot of that same silence, not for as long. So learning how to delve in and be able to confront yourself, mm-hmm. or make, and in some ways try to understand those experiences, and find a sense of community in a way, you know, where you know that you're not the only one who is going through those things. Finding that there is a place where they could come and share their ideas and try to either get beyond them or just get them onto paper. So yeah, and I found that that's what was happening in my own work with my father. Just, you know, there's a lot of feelings that people carry for many years into their lives, of course, after, for their whole lives, after an experience like that, and they come into the family, they come into the household. So I think my work kind of tries to confront that a little bit.
Well, I know Hemingway wrote about the difficulty of sharing that stuff in a short story called Soldier's Home. Mm-hmm. And I feel like your poetry and the work that you did at NYU sort of offers an alternative other than repression.
Yeah, I think that's part of what poetry is all about, learning how to delve a little bit deeper within ourselves rather than turning away from ourselves. And maybe all writing, not just poetry, pushes us to do that.
Or maybe poetry in the grander sense, as Wallace Stevens maybe would have identified it as, just sort of imaginative writing.
Mm-hmm.
So as a treat to our listeners here at the Drunken Odyssey, I was wondering if you would be willing to read your poem called Snake.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Snake. Immersed in whiskey, the heart of a snake is a drink. Nothing good can come of it. It pulses at the bottom of its little glass, still knowing, still venomous. Somewhere we are having dinner on a summer night in Copley Square. You are laughing and telling a woman you love her. My summer dress is flooded with the wind. Like in dreams, I can't speak out. I never learned to interfere. This is not a dream. Here's what happened next. I opened up his mouth and entered him, the heart, a mess of vines, a woman's hair, his teacher's voice echoing through the chambers.
So that may be one of my favorite poems in the entire world.
Thank you.
Of course, it's kind of the way you describe the heart as sort of semiotically connecting to so many different impressions and emotions. This poem just manages to spread throughout my own mind emotionally when I see it on the page, and your own reading of it is even better than it seemed on the page. So if you're blushing, if we could find some way to express that on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm shy. The poem for me, it's not necessary to say a whole lot, but I started thinking a lot about how one image can conjure another, And for a while, poetry for me came from a similar place, it seemed, that my dreams were coming from. And, you know, my real life started to feel like a dream sometimes, too. So these sort of different worlds, this way memory stays with us, and what seems sometimes to come through, like the images that we can't get rid of, and we live them over and over again, even if it's just... No matter what it's about, I think for me is sort of where poetry comes from a little bit, and they are a little bit like dreams, so maybe that was part of that.
Well, and I also get a sense of shared memory here, in which the lives of the people who are important to you are somehow not just their lives, but they're your life too.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how this book was put together. I presume a lot of it was work that you did while you were in the program.
Yeah, actually, a lot of it I've written after finishing, though there are poems that are definitely, you know, in my thesis. So I think that what I put together as a thesis project for NYU, I thought was going to be my first manuscript. But as I kept writing, I felt like, you know, I think it's our responsibility to live up to our best work, you know, as a standard. So I found myself pulling out poems constantly, like, well, this one's no good anymore. This one's no good anymore. Yeah, the book just took
a... I've outgrown that one.
Yeah. So the book just took a whole other direction in a lot of ways. But I think for me, everything started making more sense when I finally made my way towards the long poem, the Monkey Mountain poem, which just sort of started coming. And after like 10 years, like I said, of conversations and like a lot of time doing research, all of a sudden it just sort of emerged for me on the page. And then I felt like I understood what, you know, kind of what the book was or whatever at that point.
That there was kind of a gravitational pull.
Yeah. But, you know, I think we never know how our poems are going to live beside each other in a collection until we get to that point where we're trying to organize them. You know, so it's like you're sitting around with like papers spread all across the floor going like, how do these go together and what stays and what doesn't stay? It's a whole process of discovery because every time you reorder it, it creates a new feeling for the reader. You know, the books can be, however we organize our poems, it can change what the book is, you know, the feeling that it creates or whatever. So it was really stressful, actually. But.
Well, and did you find yourself writing new poems to fit maybe gaps that you saw in some order you were constructing?
I found myself thinking I was going to do that. But the way that I write, it's actually much harder to do than it is to think of the idea of like, oh, I need a poem that does, you know, X. Actually to create that poem for me and make it work, you know, make it not feel forced, make it feel like organic. Yeah, it just didn't really always work that way, it seems. So I ended up sort of building the book out of how I thought the poems could live. Like it had thinking to me that it had to start with those poems that are a little bit closer to my own voice, those poems that are closest to my own voice, and then letting the book sort of shift and tell a story, kind of create a kind of arc that is somewhat narrative for me.
I'm wondering if there is any way you could read passages from that long poem. Have you done that in readings before?
Yeah, I've done a few readings from it. I could read like a few sections. Okay, so from Monkey Mountain. Bananas there are sweeter, even green, better than sea rations, though we were glad when the choppers came. Some guys say they knew even the fruit could kill you, the way it grew so wild with chemicals on the overhang, so many city boys have to laugh. The war room should have known the jungle is its own animal, our eyes yellowing, the air something between ammonia and grass seed. We played the stones in our heads, the frequency of radio waves, monkey man, love in vain, sympathy for the devil, but none in the jungle. When her letter came, I went straight to digging foxholes for a little headspace. Figured I'd be singing to Jody before winter time. Was bound to come, and half the reason I'd reported for duty when the draft card came. Some were running to the preacher, but ask any man who signed his own name on the line, there's a woman he's forgetting, and the jungle or the ocean is as close to sewing rocks in your pockets as you can get. When the lieutenant said radio, he meant machine gun fire. Before daybreak, when our eyes adjusted just enough to pack camp, the Claymore mines disarmed. I said, location, nothing. Location, static. Location, over. I said, over. So we cut a path through the silence of insects and bird calls, and November made way to gun thunder too late. Charlie left this message, a single bullet, dead center in the head of each GI. In memory, I see nearly 30 bodies, no names, dog tags, the only offering to Charon to ensure safe passage, all the rucksacks taken. Just after dusk, we were huddled in the rear to hear the radio report of the flag raised in a crater named the Sea of tranquility. And I think we all felt right there with Buzz and Armstrong, gone from the world, but waving old glory, wondering who at home was watching or burning one. And I walked out to a clearing to see the flag blown open, knowing it must have seemed still as a photo snapped in the abyss of space, if one could see it even in the pitch dark. And somehow I was all the way brought back to November 63, balanced on the steel beams of a high rise, where in almost one sweep I watched them descend over the city, one and then another, until a massive wind blew the stars in stripes. And I still remember almost hearing taps, but didn't know gunshots rung through the morning light. Kennedy's motorcade caught in sniper's snare, and something struck, like when a deal's gone bad, and you know it's either the noose or the bluff.
These are just so good.
Thanks.
Not really the appropriate thing to say after a great poem, but... So I'm curious to know, you know, you were on the poetry side there, and the poets and the fiction writers didn't mix that much. So I'm curious what drew you to poetry and why that became an art form that you were devoting yourself to.
I think, you mean as over fiction, what drew me to poetry?
Yeah.
Okay. For me, it was to do with the music of the poems, I think, and the ability. I think there's a little more room for mystery or insinuation within a poem, but I think definitely the music was one of the things that made me feel connected to writing poetry. Felt like I understood that language instinctively, so it seemed right for me. But I have been working a little bit on, not a little bit, but hopefully more connected to fiction as well. Working on a novel now. So, yeah. And continuing to work on poetry is my first love of literature. But it's true what you were saying, you know, that the poets and the fiction writers, I think in general, not, you know, was that way within the program, and I think it's that way within the writing community, is that it seems like that that there's not a whole lot of mingling that happens in those worlds. I don't know. I think that the poets are very community oriented, and often the fiction writers seem to be a little bit more, you know, taking their solitude a little more. So, but I think it would be interesting to see how those forms come together, and that there are writers who kind of have been writing novels in verse, and, you know, poets who are writing prose poems. So it's interesting to see where those worlds collide.
Well, I remember I used to fanatically read the Paris Review, and I just had a sense of being immersed in both worlds. And I think they had, and probably still have, an interview with a poet and a fiction writer in just about every issue. Yeah, I think the more academic I became, the less, I don't know, ambidextrous I seemed.
Mm-hmm.
And it also might be one of the side effects of just, you know, education.
Yeah,
the
and
way
I think...
That,
Yeah, I think that what you're getting at, like maybe you were getting at this idea of education being so specialized or something, like people seem to be like they focus on an area, and then sometimes that prevents us from crossing into other areas, whether it's like because of a field or a particular, you know, thing that is you're sort of encouraged about, and maybe not so much on another thing, so you kind of leave it behind or something. But
yeah, or, you know, and so many of us are chasing after creative writing jobs, and there's the pressure you have to keep publishing in your specialty. So, you know, if I were to publish a book of poems, that could theoretically cost me a job if I had one in creative writing, or make it more difficult for me to gain tenure. And so I think the professionalization, that is partly an outgrowth of the way that we are educated and continue to educate ourselves in creative writing.
Yeah.
Probably leads to some of that that separation.
Yeah.
which is mostly unfortunate, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
So you've been writing your whole life. How did that start? When did you first take yourself seriously as a writer?
Well, I think I always took myself seriously, but I never expected anyone else to take it seriously. Like I wrote for myself and I was very serious about it. I think in high school, you know, I remember I filled up several of those, like, you know, 5-subject notebooks just full of poems. And I think for me, it was just how I coped with some of the things that were happening around me and in my life. So poetry was, like, for me, a necessity. But when I got to college, I started taking workshops, and then I realized, oh, you know, that maybe this was something I could share with the world. You know, this was a part of a conversation I could participate in. So yeah, I think I was probably about 18 or 19 when I started, you know, thinking more seriously about poetry. And I don't think I called myself a poet with confidence until recently. maybe even, you know, up until when this book came out, maybe even, you know, probably within the last year or two in some ways. Yeah, because it's, you know, it's hard even because there's levels of it, you know, and if you don't have the book out and then and you're among, you know, certain people and they say, oh, and you say you're a poet, and then they say, well, where can I read your work? And you're like, oh, that question. So not that that makes you a poet or doesn't, but yeah, I think, you know.
Stand right there. How much time do you have? You know, it's, yeah, I'll read it to you.
So it took me a long time to commit to you know, being able to tell other people that. I was really shy about it for a long time, but.
What was your undergrad experience like?
My undergraduate experience, I went to school for communications and media studies, and I focused in production work for film and video. I thought that was going to be my more creative outlet, you know, at that point in my life where I was going to be able to create film and productions that were poetic, essentially. But I found myself pulled into, you know, a more, it's a lot of corporate kind of structure that you're up against, you know, when you're in production. So I found myself working for companies that did commercials and industrial videos and marketing stuff. So I just decided that that wasn't what I wanted. I needed to be more true to myself as an artist and stay with that. So yeah, I kind of left that world to go back into literature.
Do you remember what your workshop experience was like way back in undergrad?
As an undergraduate, I had really encouraging professors. You know, I had a comp professor before I ever took a poetry workshop. I had a professor who's a poet who taught my composition class. His name is Christopher Bursk. God, he was the first person who taught us. He had us put our hands on our heads and kind of like rock side to side and like moan and stuff, you know. The idea of it was that, you know, sometimes you have to struggle through things. And he meant both like in life and in writing, you know, in like work. And the way he approached life was so, I don't want to say poetic because it wasn't like, you know, poetic as a grand gesture, but more the way I saw poetry, you know, like real, visceral. And he was someone who really first introduced me to what it meant to live as a poet. And then I went to Arcadia University, which was a small school. At the time, it was called Beaver College. And it was just a small college. Our workshops had, you know, maybe like 8 people or something. But I was lucky. I studied with David Keplinger, who now teaches at American University. I remember he was a student of Bruce Weigel's. And he taught the idea that poetry is born in the body. And so like being really connected to music and, you know, the senses. Also, it is okay to write our encounters with the world. You know, that's part of what poetry is that, you know, writing the encounter of a story. And so I had really great experiences in my workshops, even though, you know, there's only so much you're going to take out of sitting around a table and read your poem, someone else reads it, and then like they go to town cutting stuff out, you know. I think there's only so much to be learned from that. I think what the bigger learning is comes from reading. It comes from really thinking about what makes poetry. It comes from the discussions that can happen around that. And it does come from being able to listen to what people see as the strengths of those poems and those weaknesses. So I guess that was sort of how my workshops were.
I was wondering if you could tell a story about working with Sharon Olds.
So when I was in workshop with Sharon, you know, she really wanted to make sure that everybody connected in those first weeks of the workshop. So actually, she didn't want anybody to give criticisms right away. We weren't allowed to. Everybody wanted to. We were ready. But she really pushed us to listen to one another and to think about, you know, well, what is this person really trying to do in his or her poetry? Mm-hmm. And so therefore, like in that first workshop with Sharon, I think we really formed an incredible connection. It was really the best connection I had in a workshop ever, I think, with the other workshop participants, you know, and we pushed each other, we challenged each other and really pushed each other. And Sharon did too. Sharon would tell us, you know, where she felt we needed to be truer in our poetry and where we were already doing it. So I felt like being in workshop with Sharon really shaped some ways how I think about teaching a workshop as well, really getting everyone to come together and push each other, you know, to grow that way and challenge each other to bring in something each week that takes a risk.
Maybe that's one of the major differences between poets and most fiction writers anyway, is poets speak in something like their own voice, their own persona, which means that, you know, every confession is embarrassing, where fiction writers, you know, we could very often hide behind characters. Well, that's not me. I'm not making an ass out of myself. That's Joey.
Right. Yeah, poets either use the language in one of two ways. We either say, oh, that's the speaker of the poem. That's not me. That's the speaker of a poem. But, you know, oftentimes it's also you, and oftentimes the reader can recognize that. So yeah, there is no way to hide that. And I think people sometimes try to bury the truth in language, you know, in like really dense, confusing language and stuff like that, because it's too hard to put everything out there. Or sometimes it's just maybe too much for the reader to hear it all, you know? So maybe that's another way poets sometimes try to deal with that.
Well, and I was interested in the decision in that From Monkey Mountain sequence poem to write in other voices. I was wondering how you approached that.
Yeah, I struggled with it initially. I had always told myself I would never try to write a poem in the voice of my father or in the voice of a veteran or in the voice of someone whose experience I hadn't had. And then I found myself doing it, you know. I had received criticism in actually a fiction writing workshop about a piece that I wrote that was an omniscient perspective that did deal with a veteran character. And I got a lot of criticism about that, people who mistrusted that. So I was leery to do it, and yet I found myself doing it, and I couldn't help it. I think having spent so much time observing, you know, you grow up with someone and you see mm-hmm. the effects of these things, and then finally having these conversations where these images become kind of inherited memories, almost like, you know, that clearly I'm not, as he's telling me, I'm not experiencing what he experienced, you know? Mm-hmm. And yet suddenly these images that are really just my imagination as I'm listening to him, you're playing them over and over, especially when you're in a, you know, it's that close to you, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I found myself just writing in that voice. I couldn't help it. And it's not even, you know, just based on my father's voice. The poem deals with experiences that are not just his. And are many of some of things are just imagined, or my own emotions that were sort of tied into the speaker of the poem was what I found myself doing sometimes. So I found a lot of freedom, actually, when I finally did discover this voice, this character, this way of writing. I found a lot of freedom for myself where I could say a lot more about things I felt and questions, you know, the complexity of things that I was feeling and that I was hearing even in my Iraq veterans workshop, Iraq and Afghanistan veterans workshop, you know, some of those soldiers that I've known have talked about even now, you know, and I felt like I had sort of internalized a lot of those things. And this was one way for me to express it, you know, to get those things on the page by taking on this voice as well.
What has the feedback been about these poems?
I've been lucky. I've had good feedback so far, but honestly, I haven't had that much feedback. They're just out, so I haven't really had the chance to share them in that many audiences or with that many readers yet. So I'm interested in hearing what the response is going to be. But so far, I've had a lot of support. I've had support from the few veterans who've read it, and I've had, you know, support from my family. I've had support from, you know, my colleagues who've read the collection, and from the few audience people who I've encountered at this point who've read it as well. So I'm hoping that they're a positive thing.
What was your father's opinion? Has he heard these poems?
He's heard some of them, you know, and his reaction, you know, some of them he would just turn and say, yeah, that's kind of how it was. That's how it was. And other things, it seemed like it was, you know, some of them I think were hard for him to listen to. But he's been really supportive about what I've been doing in my writing. And, you know, he's been really understanding about what I've taken on in the book, I think, knowing that some of them are imagined, that they're not like I haven't stayed true to everything, to the truth or something like that, that my imagination is part of that. And that also this comes from a place where I need to write them. And he's been really supportive about that.
What's your writing life been like since the program wrapped up? You said a lot of the writing of the new book was work that you did after the program.
Yeah, I've found myself sort of, I think it has to do with making that full commitment to myself as a writer and to my writing, that no matter being okay with the down times when you're not writing as much, if I teach, I sometimes am not producing as much as I would like to be producing because my creative energy goes elsewhere and stuff. But I think having made that commitment to myself, I'm writing whatever I want right now. So like I said, like I'm writing poetry and I have working on another collection now. And I've started writing a novel. I've started writing essays and just other kinds of things. Just giving myself the permission to write whatever I think of, really. And having done that, I'm thinking of all kinds of things. So I just, you know, I'm constantly writing, even if it's just journaling or ideas in my notebook or titles that I'll come back to later. And I think also it's a lot of writing is just a way of encountering the world. So letting yourself be fully present and engaged in what's happening in the world, you know, whether it's just in a moment of history that, you know, you're encountering, or whether it's like listening to the news every day, or whether it's just observing social interactions on the subway, I don't know. But all of those things, being like fully awake in the world, I think is so important to giving yourself the tools you need to write poetry or to write fiction or to write whatever is coming, you know. Yeah, I think committing to that idea has really helped me write more freely.
One of the remarkable things about NYU's MFA program, and maybe it's something we just take for granted in a good program, is that all the writers seem to come out of the program sounding different. And maybe that has something to do with what Sharon Olds was doing in just getting everyone to listen before they were allowed to criticize.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about the development of your own voice as a poet?
Well, one thing that I feel exists within my own work and within my colleagues' work has a lot to do with taking risks in writing and with, I think also, I mean, this is just a vague word maybe, but voice. There's something in poems that are driven by voice that I think many of the NYU poets share, although the voices are all unique, but something in the syntax maybe, or the movement of the poems and in, you know, how they confront the world. I think that often does exist in many of our poets that come from the program there at NYU.
Well, I've been in programs, well, I've seen programs where, you know, a thesis reading and the poets could have just exchanged work and mm-hmm. It really wouldn't have made much difference. And I've heard them give readings earlier, you know, when they just got to the program and they sounded great, and then they sounded kind of okay, but all the same. It was heartbreaking.
I think that it's important for the integrity of your work. I think it's important to go through those phases where you're reading everything and you're trying new things, and those things may lead you down a path where you are writing just like so-and-so or whatever, you know. But I think it's important that you come back to yourself. and that maybe you have new tools now because you've tried new things and whatnot. And I think that when we return to ourselves as writers, like the, because, you know, we all hear wherever you're from in the world, you know, whatever little city or town or whatever, we ingest language differently. We encounter different ways of expressing ideas, colloquial terms and different music of language and a different attitude that may exist in that place and whatnot. And I think that as writers, that that's part of what makes us who we are. And returning to those places within yourself, I think, can help you to stay true to your own voice so that you're not just turning out another poem like the next person in the MFA program, you know, next to you or something. Like, you're staying sort of to your own voice that you've already come into the program with, even if it wasn't fully developed at that time.
So I've got one more request for a reading, and that would be Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving. He holds the turkey in his hands, guts the innards, pulls back loose skin from the hollow of the neck, and washes the open cavity. He's laughing when he says, "Hero," and doesn't it sound better that way? As he ties the legs, he tells me, "Out there, there was no rest. At night, we snuck through the highlands where we heard the VC were camped. In the free zone, we had orders to kill anyone. The Kong were gone, but they left chickens, and those farm boys in my platoon knew how to grab one by its head like this." He slipped his hand over my fist, the neck between two fingers. Slapped the sucker into the air. His arm shot up, then down like a whip. He said, "The chickens kicked and kicked. That night, they butchered them, plucked feathers, the guts, the gizzard, the heart, the liver." He said, "We huddled in the grass to eat the legs and wings slowly to keep night at bay. That was the first time I ever killed anything."
Thank you. That's another one of my favorites.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Lauren, and congratulations on the book publication, and I look forward to reading more of your work.
Thanks for having me, John.
And now, a book discussion, a book that changed my life.
A Fairly Divine Answer by Claude Clayton Smith. I first encountered the writing of John Updike through his short story, A&P, in an anthology for a short fiction course in college. That summer, 1965, while visiting Oxford, England, I picked up Pigeon Feathers, a collection named for one of the stories within, which included A&P and 18 others, several of which were based on Updike's experiences as a postgraduate in Oxford, set in the very streets that I was walking. All of the streets contained familiar moments and objects and scenes that Updike described with brilliant metaphors and similes in elaborate sentences, infusing the commonplace with subtle dramatic conflicts. Many of the protagonists were teenagers or adolescents, and their lives reflected my own, right down to the songs they sang and the problems they confronted. Others were newly married with children, giving me a sense of what lay in store for me a few years later. My favorite remained A&P, struck as I was by the voice of Sammy, the 19-year-old first-person narrator, who is as idealistic, romantic, yet cynical as I was then. Sammy quits his job in the humdrum A&P because the manager embarrasses three girls who enter in bathing suits in violation of store policy. There was an A&P in my hometown, and Updike's description was visually acute, right down to the cat and dog food breakfast cereal, macaroni, rice, raisins, seasoning, spread, spaghetti, soft drinks, crackers, and cookies aisle. Sammy's heroic gesture goes for naught, however, as the girls leave without noticing, and Sammy concludes, my stomach kind of fell as I felt how hard the world was going to be to me hereafter. Has he committed himself to standing up against the unjust treatment of others? Or has he acted foolishly to impress the girls? The ambiguity is poignant, but such moments permeate the entire text of Pigeon Feathers. Several years later, I read some of these stories aloud to my American literature students at Churchill High School in Potomac, Maryland. And by the time I left that school to teach at the university level, the book room had 3 class sets of Pigeon Feathers. My students took delight in seeing the lives of teenagers rendered so sensitively on the page. My first published poem, Hinc Illae Lacrimae, English Journal, October 1969, was about a high school teacher teaching, "You'll never know, dear, how much I love you," one of the stories in Pigeon Feathers. A year later, when I was at the writer's workshop at the University of Iowa, I sent a copy of that poem to Updike, asking for his autograph. He responded with an appreciative note, beginning an intermittent correspondence that spanned 4 decades. As a college professor, I continued to teach Pigeon Feathers, as well as arranging for Updike to read at Virginia Tech, then Ohio Northern University. The latter visit inspired him to write Love Factories, a collection of stories that began when we toured the Wilson Football Factory in Ada, Ohio, where my neighbor happened to be the superintendent. A few years later, I found myself making a cameo appearance in his story, The Football Factory. Later still, he referred to me and the Wilson tour in More Matter, one of his nonfiction collections. Finally, he contributed his opinion of the Dwight D. Eisenhower system of interstate and defensive highways for one of my own books, Lapping America, A Man, a Corvette, and the Interstate. When I was teaching the stories from Pigeon Feathers in high school in the late 60s, my students asked me to name my hero. These were difficult times. Martin Luther King had been assassinated, then Bobby Kennedy, and the students were confused. The high school was just 20 miles from Washington, D.C., where riots had broken out after the assassination of MLK. My hero is John Updike, I told my students, explaining that in capturing life so accurately and vividly, with all its blemishes and blessedness, he had somehow stopped time, imposed order, and made sense of it all. Every new Updike book was an event for me in those days. I would buy it in hard copy at the Savelle Bookshop in Georgetown, then repair to the tombs on Georgetown University campus to spend the afternoon reading over a pitcher of beer. I never dreamed I would come to know John Updike. Recently, following his death, I recommended Pigeon Feathers to the book group to which I belong, and it was read and received with enthusiasm. I was happy to revisit it myself and to realize how well it stands up. "Gods don't answer letters," Updike wrote in Hub Van's Bid Kid Adieu, his famous piece about Ted Williams' final at bat. "But mine did." A Fairly Divine Answer by Claude Clayton Smith was read by Joseph Longany.
And now, the Drunken Odyssey mailbag.
Adam Gottway writes, "Thank you for answering my previous ponderance. I had actually given thoughts to blogging, but there are plenty of celiac blogs already, which would be one of my main topics, I would think. I am a cornucopia of topical quandaries, and here is another. If you were to step into the realm of fan fiction, assuming your toes are as yet undipped in that literary tributary, what area would you pursue? Or is such a medium beneath the professional writer? Given that it is not, please identify at least one item that would be interesting to continue on in writing each of the following genres: film, book, television. I'm sure there are stories you would find interesting to continue. Please avoid Rule 34. On a side note, my son loves the newest Pooh film. Zooey Deschanel does all the songs and the dialogue is pretty cute and clever. I may be a bit brainwashed on it though, as I have seen it 8,367 times, sometimes even all at once. Adam, fan fiction is a bad idea for the professional writer, or any writer who wants to be a professional writer, for this basic reason. Protecting the legal rights to your own writing is next to impossible. It's not that the idea of fan fiction is beneath a serious writer. When Tom Stoppard writes Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, or John Updike writes Gertrude and Claudius, they are in essence doing fan fiction, albeit fan fiction for the acme of the literary canon, i.e. Hamlet. But Shakespeare isn't copyrighted and belongs to all of us, in a way that Star Wars, the Twilight Saga, or any number of fictional worlds do not. In my as yet unrepresented novel, Guy Psycho and the Ziggurat of Shame, I play upon the oldest epic we have ever found, that of Gilgamesh. I really enjoyed engaging with that narrative and exploring things that are merely mentioned or implied there. But I would have to admit, when I imagined my book published, I would be totally uneasy with a website devoted to fans writing their own narratives using my original characters. And rule number 34 is only part of the problem, Adam. I think that fan fiction is fine for writers who don't care about professionalization, and in some ways, writing fan fiction has to be freeing. Depending on the franchise you are devoting yourself to, there may already be an eager readership there in place, and your love of the characters of a series might be so pure that the writing of a story might be like a form of worship. We sometimes love video games where we can be our favorite characters, and writing is a video game that occurs in our heads. If you're a teenager with lots of free time and you want to write your own Star Wars novels, go ahead. That sounds like it might be good practice. But I also think that creating new characters, stories, and worlds is not quite so daunting as some people think. Speaking of Rule 34, I would be remiss if I didn't mention E.L. James's 50 Shades of Grey trilogy of erotic novels, which began as fan fiction devoted to the Twilight characters. James's two main characters began their S&M relationship, improbably, as incarnations of the Twilight couple before James reworked the material, sold her work as ebooks, and then through word of mouth became the hottest writer out there. Now, I haven't read Stephanie Meyer's or Yale James because a cursory look at random pages written by either of them demonstrated prose I simply couldn't take seriously, and I'm not vouching for or recommending these books, but I am directing your attention to the business of writing books, and E.L. James has done quite well for herself. It's fine to be inspired by work that's already out there. As for the new Winnie the Pooh film, which came out in 2011, which according to my secretary was just last year, Disney's artistic and marketing team did a lot of work to make sure that this was in the spirit of the original 1977 film. The only problem, my drunken Odysseans, is that the new film was half a remake and half a new installment of Pooh stories set in the metafictional world of a storybook. Even to a drinker like me, I could remember the first film well enough to wonder why the whole thing was not new plots. And of course, infinite variations of Pooh stories betrays the pathos of the ending of the 1977 film. That Zooey Deschanel is cute, I'll admit, and was the perfect touch for the music. Lisa Roney asks, what is the relationship between writing and cats? Do different kinds of writers prefer different species of pet? I noticed when doing my dissertation that Flannery O'Connor had her peacocks and peahens. Carson McCullers actually preferred dogs. And Catherine Ann Porter was a cat lover. I myself love all kinds of animals, but find cats most compatible with my writing needs. What do you make of this? Hemingway too loved cats, Lisa. Anyway, the reason why pets are such good companions for writers is that they can't read, don't often talk, and will even seem to listen to us when we need to talk. But they give us a sense of not being alone without being too much of a nuisance while we write, although some cats will sit on your keyboard or your papers. Alright, that's enough mail for today. I think it's drinking time. What's that, Lauren?
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions,
observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
Dear listeners, if you are enjoying the show, please recommend it to any friends who might like it also. And if you plan on doing any shopping on Amazon, please begin your shopping spree by clicking on the Amazon affiliate link located on the left-hand side of my website. All right, gang, keep your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.